a singi o.
Community Radio.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston's community station. Listener sponsored, commercial free, KPFT 90.1 FM. With live streaming and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. This show is syndicated and it airs on other radio stations in different states in the U.S. Today on Arab Voices, we will listen to a briefing Professor Rashid Khalidi delivered at the United Nations Security Council on May 27, 2021, on the steps necessary to implement UN resolutions and provide peace and security for all in Palestine. We will also listen to the remarks of Isam Yunus, director for Al Mizan Center for Human Rights in Gaza and the head of the Independent Commission for Human Rights of Palestine, as well as the remarks of Mona El Kurd, journalist and resident of Sheikh Jarrah in occupied Jerusalem. Both Isam and Mona spoke at a special session of the United Nations Human Rights Council on the grave human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, including occupied East Jerusalem. In addition, we will listen to some of the remarks delivered at the protest held in Houston in the Clear Lake area on June 5, 2021, in front of Boeing and Lockheed Martin, and attended by hundreds protesting the company's sale of weapons to Israel. But before we do that, I'd like to ask for your support and contributions to KPFT, this unique commercial-free Houston's community station, because KPFT is currently in membership drive, and that is a great opportunity to upgrade your listenership to listener sponsor. Become a member of the KPFT family. Most of you know that KPFT is mostly financed by listeners like you, and it does not rely on the corporate world to operate. So please give us a call right now at 713-526-5738 and make that tax-deductible contribution to support your community radio station. That's 713-526-5738. You can also make a pledge online at kpft.org. This station, KPFT, is unique in so many ways. It offers a diverse range of programming, like this program, Arab Voices, that has been on KPFT for over 19 years. Yes, over 19 years of weekly programming. Hundreds of topics and over 1,000 expert guests appearing on this program from around the globe. So if you appreciate what the station has been doing, I ask you to support it and keep Arab Voices and other programs on the air. Please make that call and make a pledge of any amount, whether it's $60 or $360. Call 713-526-5738 or make a pledge online at kpft.org. Your support is greatly appreciated. On Saturday, June 5th, 2021, several organizations led by the Palestinian Youth Movement organized a protest in front of Boeing Company in Clear Lake to commemorate the 54th anniversary of the 1967 war and ongoing expulsion of Palestinians from their land by racist apartheid Israel, and also protest Boeing's new plan to sell $735 million worth of precision-guided missiles to Israel, especially as Israel uses the weapons to commit genocide and war crimes against the Palestinians in occupied Palestine. Hundreds of people attended the protest. The protesters also marched 1.3 miles walking from Boeing to Lockheed Martin to protest its weapons sales to Israel, and then walked back 1.3 miles to Boeing. There were several speakers at the protest. Let's listen first to Mohammed Nabulsi with the Palestinian Youth Movement and Palestinian American Cultural Center, who was one of the organizers for the event.
They are responsible for dead bodies in Palestine. They are responsible for dead bodies in Iraq. They are responsible for dead bodies all over the world, from Vietnam to Cuba to Palestine to Syria to wherever it is. They are funding and arming these wars. And until we say enough, they will continue to do it in our names and at our expense. So we need to mobilize our pressure continuously. And not only are these companies responsible, but these elected politicians are too. They're the ones who are being lobbied and in bed with these corporations. They're the ones who line their pockets with blood money as well. And so not only are we against these companies who are complicit and make money off of war and death, we are also against these corporations, these governments that facilitate it. Because without the U.S. government's authorization, Boeing cannot sell a single dollar of weapons to anyone else. So we've made these connections. Now I want to make one more connection. You know the weapons that these companies can't sell to fight wars, where do they end up? They end up back in our communities. They end up back on police and police departments all over this country. They show up in military force. They show up in military gears. They show up in riot gear. They show up with batons. They show up with Humvees and tanks. They show up with these weapons in our cities and in our streets. And they do it, and they turn these weapons, and they turn their targets on people like us. From Ferguson to Baltimore to New York City to Detroit to Michigan to Minnesota, wherever they are, they're being handed these weapons, and we need to get these weapons off our streets. These police officers need to be reined in. They need to be stopped in terms of their behaviors towards everyday people, black and brown people in this country, okay? And Arabs and Muslims and South Asians, do not fall victim to the model minority myth. Do not let them tell you you are different and you have a way up in this country. And so ignore the lives of black and brown people in this country. Do not turn your backs on our black and brown siblings as they march in the streets. What we should be is in the streets with them. What we should be doing is joining them hand in hand, putting pressure on the public officials who are responsible for death and destruction, not just from Palestine and Gaza and Iraq, all over the world, but here in this country. That is our role. The fact that our generation, the younger generation, right now is living under crippling debt, hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, just so we can try to pick ourselves up, okay? We're graduating with degrees that don't have jobs at the end of the day, with debt that we're owed to corporations that are in bed with politicians, okay? Not only is that a reality we face, Not only do we see thousands of houseless people on the streets who could be living in vacated houses, third and fourth houses belonging to people who could be living and sheltered by the money that's going to fund these wars. Not only are we seeing that, but we're also seeing the criminalization and the militarization of our borders. We're seeing the concentrating of people who are escaping war and destruction at the hands of this country, from Mexico to Honduras to Venezuela to Colombia. Everywhere over the global south are escaping war and destruction, from Syria to Iraq, to come to this country to escape that war, a war that is funded and financed and facilitated by this country. And then they're being placed in concentration camps, and they're being detained any rights, denied any rights to counsel, to be here and live in prosperity. Those people are subject to the same system of violence. And the same companies that give security to the state of Israel, that allow it to create its apartheid wall on Palestinian land, are the same country, are the same companies that fund and finance and operate the wall on this border, on the Texas-Mexico, on the border of the US and Mexico. And so when you see children in cages, you know that the companies that have put them there and the US politicians who have put them there are the same companies and politicians that are putting Palestinians in the concentration camp that is Gaza. That are the same politicians that are responsible for our incarceration of thousands of millions of people in this country. This country incarcerates more people than any other country in the world, regardless of numbers. Not China, not India, not any other country incarcerates more people than this country. People who have issues with drug addictions, which is a public health issue, not an issue with prisons. People who are stolen from their families and thrown behind bars. These prisons are also terrorizing our communities. This policing is also terrorizing our communities. So when Boeing and Lockheed Martin and all of these companies drop bombs on our people everywhere, these people are dropping bombs in different ways on immigrants, on black and brown people, on working class and working poor people of this country. Okay? So our struggles, we're making these connections not because we want to compare our struggles to others and say, oh, I sympathize with you because you're going through similar things. I'm not doing that for that reason. We should. Even if it wasn't happening to us, we should have sympathy and stand with them. But we should stand with them also because they, the enemies of them, is the enemies of us. Their enemies are our enemies. And they are with us, we are with them. So victims everywhere, oppressed people everywhere.
That was Mohammed Nabulsi, one of the organizers for the protest held in front of Boeing and Lockheed Martin on June 5th. Patrick Higgins also spoke at the event. He is a PhD candidate at the University of Houston and is currently finishing his dissertation on Palestinian perceptions on U.S. imperialism in the Arab world from the 1950s to the early 1970s, and how those perceptions shaped theory and strategy of the Palestinian cause. Let's listen in.
Thank you to all organizers and Palestinian youth movement in particular. And I do have a prepared statement for today to talk about the ways that Boeing is connected to the violence we're seeing perpetrated against the Palestinian people daily. But I do want to just make a quick remark about what we saw. What Houston Police Department just did was disgusting, absolutely disgusting. And we see in their targeted harassment of our comrade, who all of us, I want to thank everybody who went up there to protect our comrade, because we need to show that as we stand against state violence in Palestine, that we're going to stand against it here, that we're not going to stand for it at all. And I think it's quite relevant to point out that the very weapons manufacturers, like Boeing, that supply the racist state of Israel, sell their surplus weapons to the police here to do what? To attack us and prevent us from speaking out against Boeing, from speaking out against these policies.
Yes.
Enough of it. We got you, comrade. Okay. So today, I just want to say, what does the company posted in this building next to us do on a daily basis? And how does it relate to the horrifying violence we see Israel inflict daily on the Palestinian people? Of course, the answer is simple enough. They, along with a couple other U.S.-based monopolies, such as Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and Raytheon, make the highly sophisticated, imminently deadly weapons that the Zionist state uses to maim and kill Palestinians. It's worth dwelling for a moment, though, on the whole industrial process behind Boeing's production of deadly weapons. This process starts with raw materials, tearing up the earth to mine rare metals used to make modern weapon systems. Cobalt, which is used in lithium-ion batteries that power electronic system weapon systems, as well as metal alloys, are mined from Democratic Republic of the Congo and Zambia. Tin and zinc, which also go into the metal alloys that make up weapons and armed planes, are mined in places such as Bolivia, Nigeria, and South Africa. So the process begins in Africa, East Asia, and South America. And the mining of these metals is a notoriously brutal labor process. In the Congo, which is estimated to produce over 80% of the world's cobalt, the path for Western mining companies to lucrative contracts was opened up by war in the 1990s after Rwanda and Uganda invaded. Mining companies made deals directly with warlords who drove and still drive child laborers into dangerous mines, in some cases for less than a dollar a day. Whether we are talking about electronics or weapons, which are two industries that are increasingly bound together, the basis for their profits today is child labor and war. And note the circular process at work here. The rich Euro-American nations, including Britain, France, Germany, and here in the United States, send our invading armies and send weapons into places like the Congo, effectively manufacturing wars for the purpose of creating more and bigger weapons to be used in future wars. And to relate this directly now to Palestine, there is the manufacturing of the parts, the weapons and factories full of underpaid, overworked workers in dangerous conditions in Asia. Then the weapons are manufactured in Boeing factories to be sold to the very U.S. government that subsidized Boeing's production in the first place using your tax dollars. When Boeing or Raytheon or Lockheed Martin go to the market their products through brochures, they brag about how effectively these weapon systems can liquidate so-called security threats, by which they mean, among other peoples, the Palestinian people, themselves a people without a state, and therefore denied an army, systematically denied precision weapons with which they might defend against the theft of their land and their homes. But you know the lingo the weapons manufacturers use to refer to the fathers, brothers, daughters, uncles and aunts, nieces and nephews, farmers, teachers, and nurses, and so forth in Palestine, who end up on the receiving end of Boeing's corporate firepower. They call them terrorists. All through the process, speculators and investors and traders are encouraged to buy Boeing stock based on its ability to provide the tools for Israel to vaporize human life in Gaza. Throughout the entire process, from Central Africa to North America to West Asia, profits accumulate from the destruction of life on Earth and even of the Earth itself. This is why I say to you, to support Palestine is to defend humanity in general. I want to add that we have legal grounds for stopping these weapons transfers. Now, when I invoke the law here, I want to acknowledge first that law is a site of struggle. So it doesn't always line up with what we might deem to be morally correct. But when the law is morally correct, it more often than not comes as the product of popular struggles like we're doing here today. Therefore, where possible, we have to use the full power of the law insofar as it helps us to achieve justice. So I advise you to study the Leahy laws or the Leahy amendments, which prohibit the U.S. State Department and Department of Defense from providing military assistance to foreign security forces that violate human rights with impunity. Israel fits that bill. Similarly, there's the Arms Export Control Act. So we should not be shy that saying, in addition to violating international law, the U.S. arms assistance and sales to Israel violates U.S. law. And we need to press this issue, just like our forebears in the anti-war movement pressed the issue outside of Dow Chemical when it was manufacturing napalm to kill Vietnamese communities and ripping them apart. And believe me, these were small groups when they started outside of corporate headquarters. So that means, and then they were treated as a bunch of kooks at first, and then eventually it blossomed into a mass movement. Finally, I want to make one more point. I want to end on a point about which rights are due to the Palestinian people, which imperialism has turned into refugees and captives. Their right to resistance as an occupied people facing foreign domination includes armed resistance, and it's elemental. It's codified in international law through the Geneva Conventions in 1949, UN General Assembly Resolutions 3314 of 1974, and 3742 of 1982. But just as important, as a basic moral point, we need to insist that they can't be denied the right and ability to resist their occupier while we pay for the vast billion-some-dollar weapons shipments airlifted into heavily guarded Zionist holding bases. Look at this building right here behind us and think about the global scope of the powers arranged against Palestinians. Their right to resist is as fundamental as the right of Sitting Bulls or Red Clouds was against the U.S. Army here in North America. And I know for saying this much, certain Zionist outfits have tried to paint me, and I'm sure other people here, as so-called terrorism supporters, as if we just love violence and bloodshed. But I call that projection, especially because I am a supporter of peace, and I believe the Palestinian resistance, which has bravely challenged the U.S. and Israel's awesome military might to save the existence of the Palestinian people and compel the world to care about their national cause, are ultimately the truest strugglers for peace among us. This statement will only seem counterintuitive to those who bought into the propagandists of anchors, pundits, academics, politicians, think tankers, who perverted and inverted the meaning of that word peace. The extermination of a people, of any people, is not peace. Capitulation and surrender of a people without reparations is not peace. And the blockade and siege of Gaza and the resulting manufactured poverty with its outbreak of disease and psychological distress is not peace. Those fighting for Palestinian liberation in return, the form of just reparations stipulated in UN General Assembly Resolution 194, are therefore the truest forces of peace against those powerful interests, including Boeing, which act haughty and dine extravagantly off the blood of the great and defiant Palestinian people. Long live the great Palestinian people!
That was Patrick Higgins, a PhD candidate at the University of Houston, speaking at the protest held in front of Boeing on June 5, 2021, in the Houston area. Mona El-Kurd, a Palestinian journalist, activist, and resident of Sheikh Jarrah in occupied Jerusalem, has been actively protesting and refusing to leave her own house in occupied Jerusalem despite Israel's repeated attempts at forcing her out of her own house. On Sunday, June 6, the Israeli occupation forces stormed her house in Sheikh Jarrah and arrested her and her brother, Muhammad El-Kurd, who is also very active against the Israeli atrocities and ethnic cleansing, and took them both to Israeli interrogation. Then they released them. Mona El-Kurd spoke on May 27, 2021, at a special session of the United Nations Human Rights Council on the grave human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem. Let's listen in to her remarks. The voice you will hear is that of the translator, because she spoke in Arabic.
Good morning, everybody. Good afternoon. My name is Mina El-Kurd, and I'm a resident of Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem, eternal capital of Palestine. I'd like to tell you the story of my home. It's a suburb of Jerusalem, historic Jerusalem. This area was built in 1957 following an agreement concluded between Jordan and Palestine in order to cope with 28 families who were removed from historic Jerusalem. They were rehomed as a result of the agreement 3 years later. We were to be given this territory as a result of the agreement. Unfortunately, that didn't happen. Then war broke out in 1967 and the Israeli occupation took over the remaining part of Palestine. Jordan was no longer present or a great influence in the region. In 1971, the settler associations accused residents, saying that we were not historic bloodline residents. There were accusations like this, despite the fact that our habitation in the region went back to the 1960s. These were fallacious accusations, and these settler organizations were attempting to push forward their occupation without any documentation. The Israeli occupation wanted our property rights not to be properly examined. As a result, what has happened in Sheikh Jarrah is a model for the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. There is a plot at hand between the Israeli government and colonial businesses in order to separate out the land. There is an apartheid in place. Settlers can move around completely freely and in a protected fashion, while we, the Palestinians, have no entitlement to move freely. And in Sheikh Jarrah, this now goes back 14 days in a far more severe manner because the area is illegally sealed off. And we have no idea why. We, the residents of this suburb, can only go out with all of our ID papers, but no loved ones, no friends, nobody can get into this area. Unfortunately, says the interpreter, the audio has become inaudible. It returns. So we have been cut off once again. We have no solidarity to support us, while settlers, on the other hand, are able to move freely. The colonial violence we have suffered, which the occupying forces are using against us, Palestinians who have been struck and arrested during peaceful demonstrations, is extreme and barbaric. In the Sheikh Jarrah suburb, where we've demonstrated peacefully to call for our rights to our lands, to the areas of the city where we've been born, we have been suppressed. We are fired upon by using rubber bullets, not only in the streets, but in our homes, in our houses. Some days ago, a child of 11 years of age, Shana Al-Keshwani, was shot at using rubber bullets while she was at home in her house. Police officers demanded that they come into her home. She had done nothing. She accepted those orders, let them into her house, and when she turned her back, she was shot at with rubber bullets. Today, she's suffering from her injuries. These are barbaric attacks which target us on a daily basis. What is happening in Sheikh Jarrah violates human rights and international law. We are in the process of seeing a substitution of one ethnic group with another. These are war crimes. What is happening in Palestine, and more precisely in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, is a war crime. It's a war crime which has been committed on a number of occasions. Forced displacement is a war crime. Ethnic cleansing is also a war crime. And according to international law, Israel has no sovereignty in East Jerusalem. And I repeat, this is pursuant to international law, but Israel has no respect for that and cannot be dissuaded. The colonial courts are completely unfair, and sentences are skewed in favour of the settlers. All of the systems and infrastructure are brought to bear to support the settlers in Palestinian areas. The settler organisations which are trying to take over Sheikh Jarrah lands have no property rights underpinning their actions. There is also a complicity between the occupying state and the settlers themselves, by way of example. We have there was a slogan that we had written that saying you're welcome in Sheikh Jarrah suburb, which was rubbed out, and the settlers considered those who were behind it as undertaking racist acts, which was completely wrong. We've done nothing against the settlers, quite the opposite. They were received warmly and welcomed, and the municipality tried to send out civil servants in order to rub out what we'd written, the welcoming messages we'd written, in order to make the settlers feel welcome. But the settlers decided to delete them, to erase them. Why are the municipalities rubbing out what we've written on the walls of our homes? It exacerbates the apartheid racial segregation, which is meted out against us. I'd like to also briefly touch on the matter of my own house specifically. In 2000, my father decided to add an annex to our house. The sound is lost. My father asked for a permit from the municipality to construct. This was rejected, unfortunately. 94% of permits for building are rejected, because those requests are submitted by Palestinians, above all in Jerusalem. My father had built a house. He should have been entitled to build an annex because he'd been married and had had children, and the space was insufficient for that size of family. But he was surprised to see that the judge himself came to our house. He came to our house and closed the house, saying that it had been built without any authorization. So for 9 years the house was completely shut up. We've been looking at this house and dreaming about living there. We've paid around 100,000 shekels of fines as a result of this erroneous judgment. 9 years later we were surprised to see that there was an iniquitous decision taken by the colonial court saying that Israeli settlers could move into that house, despite the fact that allegedly it hadn't had any permit to build it, according to them. The occupying forces suddenly decided it was completely legal for the settlers to live there, and so since 2009 I've been sharing my own house with settlers. That's my own personal story in Sheikh Jarrah suburb, but it's also the story of 500 people who have always lived in that part of town, large families with children and grandchildren. We've never wanted to leave our homes. We didn't want to live in the street, but there was no alternative for us. We wanted to stay in our homes. This flies in the face of international law and the principles of humanitarianism. what's happening in Sheikh Jarrah and everywhere in Palestine falls into that category. The occupation must stop as soon as possible. Palestinians are entitled to live in peace and security in our country, Palestine, from the river to the sea.
That was Mona El-Kurd, or translator of Mona El-Kurd's remarks. Mona El-Kurd is a Palestinian journalist, activist, and resident of Sheikh Jarrah in occupied Jerusalem. She spoke on May 27th at a special session of the United Nations Human Rights Council on the grave human rights situation in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem. Essam Younes, director for Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights in Gaza and the head of the Independent Commission for Human Rights of Palestine, also spoke at that Human Rights Council on May 27, 2021. By the way, during the 2014 Israeli war on Gaza, Israel killed Essam's father, stepmother, and his four-year-old niece. Let's listen in to his remarks.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I'm Essam Younes. Today, I'm speaking to you with my capacity as the Commissioner General of the Palestinian Independent Commission for Human Rights. I'm also the Director General of the Gaza-based Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights. I'm also Palestinian, born and raised in Rafah, and now live in Gaza City with my family. We are again gathered for special session of the Council because as member states, you have a choice. You have a choice to make because of what recent and long-standing event occurring in Israel and Palestine. You have a choice to make because of the systematic impunity your government grant to Israel. You have a choice because Israel, with its firm control over Palestinians in the OPT, and Israel, with its vast military power and technology, and with the support of leading countries, decided to use its power to deliberately attack civilians, to attack and kill indefensible children within the sanctity of their homes. Between the 10th and 21st of May in Gaza, the Israeli military killed 253 Palestinians, including 66 children, many of them in their homes, while they slept without warning. The subject is particularly raw of me because it was in Israel's 2014 assault that one night, while my father, my stepmother, and my four-year-old niece slept in their beds, the Israeli military bombarded their neighborhood and killed them in their sleep. All over Gaza, for 11 days, entire families were huddled in hallways and living on kitchen floors because those seemed like the safest places. But nowhere is safe in Gaza. The Israeli military destroyed 1,800 homes and damaged upwards of 14,000 more. When many families and I received the warning to evacuate last week, we were lucky to have a relative's home to share. On the nearly 60,000 people who were made homeless, many are living in appalling humanitarian conditions in makeshift shelters. Israel's unlawful closure, 14-year collective punishment, was heightened its devastating impact on social, economic, cultural, and environmental rights for 2 million people. This May, Israel destroyed 23 hospitals and medical partially and totally. The only sewage plant was made inoperable. The 12-story tower that housed Al Jazeera and the AP was brought to the ground, which meant that getting information out was made ever more difficult. Israel chose to use its power to escalate on all fronts. First, with its continued attempts to ethnically cleanse Palestinians in Jerusalem and then across the OPT and Israel. With excessive force, mass arbitrary arrests, and state-sanctioned mob violence. Right now, the Israeli authorities are again escalating with an arrest campaign in Jerusalem and of Palestinian citizens in Israel. But these recent events are only a symptom. The problem is that for 73 years, the Palestinian people have endured systematic, institutionalized, and long-established laws, policies, and practices that aim to impose and maintain the settler colonial regime of racial domination and oppression over Palestinians on both sides of the Green Line. If you read recent reports by international and regional organizations, you know that this apartheid regime encompasses not just Palestinians in the OPT, but also those of us in Israel and those of us as refugees and in exile abroad. Israel's forced inequality is sanctioned and supported by states in this council, which should uphold our collective values of fairness, justice, security, and equality. In applying the rule of law, the Palestinian people should not be an exception. And so today, you have a choice, either to vote in favor of the resolution before you, to move us forward under the shelter of international law, or to withhold your support and choose geographical and economic interest. Please listen to the speakers today, in particular to the people impacted on the ground with an ear tuned to international law and the principles of this council. Thank you.
That was Essam Younis, director for Al Mizan Center for Human Rights in Gaza and the head of the Independent Commission for Human Rights of Palestine, speaking at the Human Rights Council on May 27, 2021. You're listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Shortly, we will listen to a briefing Professor Rashid Khalidi delivered at the United Nations Security Council on May 27, 2021, on the steps necessary to implement United Nations resolutions and provide peace and security for all in Palestine. Reminder that KPFT Houston's community station is currently in fund drive, and because KPFT relies on your support to operate, I am asking you to please call us right now and make a tax-deductible contribution. Listeners who take the step to become contributors are our most important source of funding. During this membership drive, please make a gift in support of the wide variety of shows that matters more than ever on KPFT. Give online at kpft.org or call 713-526-5738. Members are the single most important source of funding for 90.1 KPFT. Why don't you call right now to make your membership investment and become a part of that important source? 713-526-5738 is the number, or you can give online at kpft.org. And if you make your membership a sustaining one, you'll be supporting this station for years to come. 713-526-5738. The United Nations Security Council asked Professor Rashid Khalidi to brief the Council on May 27, 2021, on the steps necessary to implement United Nations resolutions and provide peace and security for all in Palestine. Professor Rashid Khalidi, whom we've had live on this program before, is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University in New York, editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies, and author of many books, including The Hundred Years' War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917-2017. Let's listen in to his remarks at the United Nations Security Council. I'd like to thank Laura Albust with the Institute for Palestine Studies for providing me with the audio recording.
Mr. President, distinguished members of the Security Council, I'm deeply grateful to the Council and to the Chinese Presidency for the opportunity to brief you, particularly at what may be a new juncture in the evolution of the question of Palestine. Palestinians, wherever they are, in occupied Arab East Jerusalem, where the latest round of violence started a few weeks ago, in the occupied West Bank, in besieged Gaza, inside Israel, and in the vast Palestinian diaspora, all of them have responded to the events of the past several weeks with an unprecedented degree of unity. These events and this show of unity have provoked a worldwide recognition of the realities on the ground, realities of systemic discrimination, of oppression, and of settler colonialism that can no longer be brushed aside and hidden by stale cliches. Young people and people of conscience the world over have responded to the images that emerged from different parts of Palestine and that were diffused especially by social media, but also by the mainstream media. Public discourse has begun to shift in consequence. On June 9th, 1967, at the height of the June 1967 war, as a college student, I sat in the visitors' gallery of this very chamber where you are sitting, watching as a permanent member ensured the impunity which allowed a member state to ignore Security Council ceasefire resolutions and continue its military offensive for another 24 hours. This action nearly 54 years ago exacerbated problems that this body is still wrestling with. The same pattern of guaranteeing impunity for violations of international law and Security Council resolutions has recurred repeatedly since then, most recently during this council's deliberation on events in Palestine earlier this month. As you all know, since the founding of the United Nations, the Security Council has passed multiple resolutions on the Palestine problem and the Arab-Israeli conflict. These issues have taken up more of the time and energy of your body than any other global issue. Most of these resolutions have not been implemented or respected. In effect, they are dead letters. This systemic disrespect for Security Council resolutions, encouraged by the impunity I have described, has left this council and the United Nations itself, I am sad to say, in justifiable disrepute. Most seriously, this impunity has been a major obstacle to establishing peace, justice, and security for all who live in Palestine and Israel. I've not been asked to brief on the failings of the past, however. Instead, I hope to offer suggestions based on my understanding of the history of this issue to reinforce the efforts of this body to achieve lasting peace and security in Palestine and Israel in the future. It is clear to me, and I hope it is clear to you, that whatever their merits, a number of important palliatives currently under consideration are not by themselves going to produce a lasting solution for the problems of Palestine and Israel. They include rebuilding the degraded infrastructure of Gaza with no guarantee that it will not be destroyed for a fifth time. They include stressing quality of life for Palestinians without providing them with a clear and fixed political horizon. They include, finally, yet again, launching a meaningless peace process that is structured by the most powerful actors to avoid all of the difficult core issues central to achieving a sustainable resolution of this issue. Any effort to achieve real peace and security must belatedly grapple with these painful core issues that go back to the first efforts of the General Assembly and this Council to deal with the question of Palestine in the earliest years after the establishment of the United Nations. What are these core issues? They are the dispossession of the Palestinian people starting in 1948. They are the status of Jerusalem. They are the supposedly temporary military occupation that has endured since 1967. And they are ensuring that any projected solution is grounded in international law and in the resolutions of this council and is not based on whatever happens to be convenient for the most powerful actors involved in this issue. I am a historian of the Middle East and a longtime observer of the proceedings of this council. My father worked in the Security Council for nearly two decades as a member of the UN Secretariat. I understand perfectly that power relations structure what is possible and what is impossible. I understand perfectly how difficult it is to make national agendas coincide such that collective action becomes possible. However, if there were a moment to transcend these restraints and for collective action to address a source of suffering that has endured for the better part of a century, this is it. The most recent upheaval in Palestine and Israel has sharpened contradictions, has aroused new passions, some of them ugly, and has awakened consciences. It has also pricked the bubble of cherished illusions, such as the illusion that no one in the Arab world or globally cares about Palestine. The solidarity marches, the social media explosion, the unprecedented nature of mainstream media coverage of recent events, the unprecedented wave of solidarity with Palestinians the world over, all of these phenomena together show that however much some might wish that this were not the case, Palestine is important and cannot be ignored. They also show that the Palestinians will not give up their struggle to achieve their inalienable rights. A problem that many for decades have hoped would disappear has reappeared in an even more intense and troubling form. This is therefore time to call a spade, and to abandon the cruel false equivalence that ignores casualty ratios of from 4 or 10 or 20 to 1, that places the occupier on the same footing as the occupied, and that puts a nuclear-armed regional superpower on the same footing as a people that has never been allowed to enjoy self-determination. If this false equivalence is maintained, if the lopsided balance of power between the two peoples is allowed to dictate outcomes, there will never be an end to this bloodletting and oppression, and the Security Council will continue to issue empty resolutions with no force for the rest of the 21st century, as it has done for many of the past decades. Mr. President, Excellencies, how can the impunity which enormous power grants to one side be overcome? What are needed, in my view, are both small steps and big steps. Small steps can include this body urgently demanding, not requesting from the blockading powers, but demanding, under penalty of sanctions, that the humanitarian and medical and dietary and other basic needs of the people of Gaza be freed of cruel political considerations, and that the collective punishment of 2 million people be ended. Surely this small step is within the power of the Security Council. I think all can see how doing this, which requires forceful action, would ameliorate the situation in Palestine. Small steps include the Security Council working to help cement the unity of the Palestinian people on a democratic basis, a unity that the colonial power has worked ceaselessly to undermine. This could include United Nations mandated and supervised elections that can be obstructed neither by the occupying power nor by outside powers that cultivate proxies and meddle in Palestinian affairs. Small steps might include the demand that the status quo regarding the holy sites in Jerusalem, a status quo that has been systematically infringed upon, be strictly respected by all. This status quo goes back not only to the many UN resolutions on Jerusalem or to the British Mandate period. It is rooted in the era of Ottoman rule. It was hammered out over many decades of war and diplomacy. As we have seen in recent weeks, it is playing with fire, an unholy fire, to allow this status quo to be trampled upon, as has been happening for all too many decades, both in the period of Jordanian rule of the eastern part of the city, and especially since the Israeli occupation and annexation of 1967. Larger steps might include should include reiterating forcefully the basic building blocks of the international order as far as Palestine is concerned, as these have been laid down in Security Council and other UN resolutions. These include the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by force, central principle of resolution passed by this body in November 67, the illegality of the colonization of occupied territory by the occupier citizens, as laid out in the Fourth Geneva Convention, the right of refugees to return and to compensation, as laid out in UN General Assembly Resolution 181, and the necessity of an international role in resolving the question of Jerusalem, as has been laid out in repeated Security Council resolutions. For the Council simply to reiterate clearly and explicitly that these building blocks, rooted all of them in international law and in UN resolutions, are the only possible basis of a just and lasting solution would ameliorate the situation immeasurably. I understand how difficult it may be to achieve unanimity today, even on these points, every single one of which has been voted for unanimously or nearly unanimously by this Council or other UN bodies in the past, but this is crucially important, simply reiterating them. Another larger step would be for the Council to assert its prerogatives and push forcefully for a more multilateral and less unilateral structure for resolution of the Palestine question. The unilateral approach, which has prevailed since the Gunnar Jahring mission, which was eclipsed towards the end of the 1960s, a half century ago, has manifestly failed to bring peace to Palestine or to Israel. And it is time for it to be replaced by more multilateral and less biased efforts. I understand that power has its prerogatives and cannot be ignored, but it is time to realize that a century of unmitigated failure should bring this body to search for a better, a more multilateral way to structure a negotiation than the unilateral one that has been followed with no success until now. A much bigger step, albeit one that should not be so hard for this body to adopt or for the world community to accept, is the principle that in any projected solution in Palestine, Israel, all citizens of both the Palestinian and Israeli peoples and both collectivities must enjoy rights and security on a basis of complete equality. Whatever rights one enjoys, the other must enjoy as well. These rights include the right of self-determination and political, civil, human, and religious rights. This is not such a far-fetched notion. In November 1947, the UN General Assembly voted for the creation of two states in Palestine. One was eventually established, one was not. For all its many flaws and the injustice to the overwhelming Arab majority of the Palestinian population that it embodied at that time, this resolution contained one kernel that we can look back on and build on. This is the indisputable principle that two peoples live in Palestine, Israel. In whatever way these two peoples are to structure their relations in the future, whether on a two-state or on some other basis, the weaker cannot be left to the mercies of the stronger, with its powerful ally putting its thumb on the already tilted scales. This is where the Security Council can and must play a role by insisting that the principle of complete equality of rights and international law be the essential basis of any lasting solution. Mr. President, I know a little bit of the difficulties that your excellencies and the states you represent must confront in dealing with this intractable issue. I understand that it is an issue that has profound resonance within the internal politics of your countries, and that it is an issue that provokes intense passions on all sides. Nevertheless, this is the moment to grasp that sharp nettle, to bring concepts of right, principle, justice, and equality to bear in order to overcome the decades of expediency that have given the hollow shell of a process, but have manifestly not brought peace to Palestine or to the two peoples who live there. As I have recently written, rather than bringing peace, the efforts of the United Nations and outside parties in Palestine have all too often failed to prevent further displacement, further misery, further war. May the opportunity presented by the most recent crisis in Palestine and Israel lead this council to efforts that will break this pattern and set the two peoples on the path towards a just, lasting, and sustainable peace and real, equal security. Thank you very much.
What you just heard was a briefing delivered by Professor Rashid Khalidi at the United Nations Security Council on May 27, 2021, on the steps necessary to implement United Nations resolutions and provide peace and security for all in Palestine. You're listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of the show. Did you know that this program, Arab Voices, has been on the air since April 2002? That's right, over 19 years of weekly Arab Voices programming. Nearly 1,000 programs covering different topics with more than 1,000 expert guests appearing on this show from around the globe. All of that has been possible because of your support to KPFT, Houston's community station, our community radio station. And it is time for the membership drive. Please call right now to support KPFT at 713-526-5738 and make a tax-deductible contribution or make it online at kpft.org. Every dollar counts. Think of the value you get out of KPFT and really for everyone who listens. You know that not everyone can contribute, but if you can and appreciate what KPFT brings you every day, please consider a pledge because KPFT relies on you, the listener, for support. The phones are open. There is room for your call. Help keep up the momentum. Call 713-526-5738. I'd like to thank all who called in to support KPFT and Arab Voices. It's not too late to call 713-526-5738 or donate online at kpft.org. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.
Radio, KBOO Portland.
Today on Wings, the topic is Lois Weber, groundbreaking creator of silent films about women, and some of the other women with whom she worked.
There's a river of birds.